I'm Tanya Mosley, and I want to thank you for listening to the Here and Now podcast. I also want to ask you to do something. Support your NPR station with a donation right now at donate.npr.org/now. Your contribution supports the reporting you hear every day, the latest from Washington, where a new administration is preparing to take over, and reporting from across the country on the surge of COVID-19 cases. Your donation ensures that you're hearing a range of voices, the experts, and also the everyday people who are experiencing all of this right now, like we all are. You're also helping to make possible those unforgettable interviews with authors, big thinkers, and creatives in the fine arts and popular culture. Those moments that make you want to listen every day. So make a donation to your NPR station now. Your contribution is more important than ever. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now let's get to the news.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Trump is expected to sign the $900 billion coronavirus relief bill today, with important provisions like direct payments to many Americans of up to $600 and an additional $300 a week for the unemployed. But there's also legislation unrelated to the pandemic, including what some are calling the most significant congressional action on climate change in a decade. Congress has approved $35 billion to fund clean power, tax credits for wind and solar, as well as drawing down the use of hydrofluorocarbons, or HFCs, a chemical used in refrigerators and air conditioning units that is speeding up climate change. Let's find out more about that. Joining us now is Stephen Urich, Chief Executive of the Air Conditioning, Heating, and Refrigeration Institute. It's a group that represents the industry. Stephen, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Peter. Appreciate being here.
And I think it's worth noting that this law was supported by industry groups like yours, by environmental groups, and also by Republican and Democratic senators. Why is that?
Because it's a great bill that does... You know, it has great environmental benefits, but the real greatness of it is it's about economics and jobs and U.S. manufacturing. And because of that, it brought everything together into a great package. And it also represents a lot of work that not only my staff and industry have done, but also the Republicans and Democrats in Congress, as well as the environmental groups, where we all got together and said we need to move this forward. And we need to do this for the environment, and we need to do it for the economy.
Well, let's be clear about how bad HFCs are for the environment. They're a very powerful greenhouse gas with 1,000 times the heat-trapping power as traditional fossil fuel emissions. So as you say, that's why the environmental groups like it. What is the calculation for you on the economic side? Why does it make good economic sense to draw these chemicals down?
Well, it makes good economic sense because... One, the environmental benefits, as you said, but two, it's the U.S. technology. We've been leading and we're the inventors of refrigeration and air conditioning, and we want to continue with that. And these technologies, as we recognized back in the 80s, when the refrigerants that were being used were depleting the ozone, the industry stepped forward, worked with environmentalists, passed the Montreal Protocol. Here we saw that the refrigerants that were replacing them, the ozone-depleting ones, had an environmental impact. And so we said, we need to develop something better. We know that we need, and people need refrigeration. They need comfort cooling, especially today with vaccines. We need to make sure that those things are transported safely and are done. So we need to have these refrigerants. And so as an industry, we did the research, spent the money, came up with better refrigerants that provide that refrigeration, that comfort cooling, and we want to sell those refrigerants not only here in the U.S., but be the leader globally.
Okay, so in the next 15 years, the legislation would reduce HFCs to just 15% of 2012 levels. But are you saying that you've already created the alternatives to these HFCs? Help me understand that, because why can't you just start selling them?
Because in the market, it takes a period of time. This equipment has useful lives from anywhere from 15 to 20 to 25 years. And so people aren't going to be able to replace today something they just put in a couple of years ago, and we don't want to. That's not economic. It doesn't make sense. And so there needs to be, just like we did with the ozone-depleting refrigerants, a period of transition where new products are put in, either in new construction or in replacing old equipment, but you continue to be able to service the equipment that's in and still has a useful life in homes and businesses.
In 2016, 197 countries signed the Kigali Accords. You know that because you were there. That agreed to phase out HFCs, but the Trump administration never ratified it. What does it mean now to have the U.S. in compliance with that treaty, which is what this law will do? It means that the U.S. Will be in compliance with the treaty, at least in spirit, whether or not it's ratified by the U.S. Senate.
One, it again puts us forward as the leader in this. We were the ones, the U.S. and the U.S. industry, that pushed forward the Kigali Amendment over 10 years to get it done. We are now showing that we are stepping up and implementing it, and it has great economic and trade benefits, because if we weren't in compliance, unlike a lot of other treaties or protocols, this one had teeth. And if we weren't part of it, by 2030, no U.S. products could be sold into countries that had ratified the agreement. And so, you know, we needed to be in compliance. We needed to do it so that this technology could be there and that we could continue to have the jobs and the manufacturing here in the U.S.
Stephen Urich, Chief Executive of the Air Conditioning, Heating, and Refrigeration Institute. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
Well, Inauguration Day is less than a month away, and this one will be different by necessity because of the pandemic. Of course, there's also the specter of President Trump not conceding. He challenged the election again today in tweets with baseless claims of ballots being thrown out. CNN's Barbara Starr reports growing anxiety in the Pentagon. Will President Trump order military action somewhere or draw the military into his campaign to reverse the election results? But there will likely be an inauguration of Joe Biden in January. It will be different. And Julian Zelizer says it's time. He's professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. And Julian, you know, first, your thoughts on what we're hearing about a president who won't accept the results of an election he lost. Ever happened before?
No. I mean, there were rumors that Richard Nixon in the final days of the Watergate scandal was going to do something dramatic to stay in office. But presidents who have been defeated have left. And this would be another new moment for Trump if this actually came to pass.
Well, we're assuming the traditional transfer of power will happen on January 20th, and it will be different because of the pandemic. And you argue in a recent opinion piece for CNN that it's time, as I said, for change, and it gives the planning committees an opportunity because inaugurations were never written in stone anyway. So tell us more about what you would like to see with change.
Yeah, obviously for the Biden inauguration, it's going to be important because of public health. And also even symbolically, this is a president who has committed to doing things differently. The DNC this summer offered a model. I think doing more stuff virtually allowed a greater number of voices to be part of the event, such as the roll call, when we saw delegates all over the country and in their local communities, even to performances that are done by different groups who represent the diversity and pluralism of this country. I think there's just a wonderful opportunity in an event that has changed over time to make this in some ways more inclusive, less about fundraising, and more innovative in how we bring people in.
Well, let's talk about how it's changed over time. Calvin Coolidge's 1925 inauguration was the first broadcast on radio. President Truman's in 1949, the first to be televised. Let's see a little clip.
Mr. Chief Justice, fellow citizens, I accept with humility the honor which the American people have conferred upon me.
And so, Julian, you're saying maybe, you know, go further this time around. Maybe all be televised or all be online because of how successful the Democratic National Convention was in doing that. And you talk about doing as they did, hopscotch across the country, have people in groups in different places. But isn't there something lost if you're not out there on the mall freezing your butt off normally? You know, even if you're a mile back, you're there, you know, when, let's say, the first Black American becomes president of the United States. Isn't there something to that moment?
Of course. You don't have to throw out all the great elements of the ceremony with newer innovations. I think both can be part of it. Obviously, there won't be much of a choice this time. There is something to being there in person, but I do think we can greatly broaden what the event is. And we need to remember, even the location has changed over time. There's been many that have not taken place with the grand formality that we're talking about. In 1985, Reagan had to basically cancel much of the ceremony because it was going to be freezing, and he was scared that people were going to get frostbite if they were standing outside. So he did the oath inside, and just in front of a small crowd, there was a celebration later. So this doesn't have to be the same.
Right, and some people may think, oh, they've always gotten out of their car, you know, and the procession and walk. No, that's not true. Just remind us, Jimmy Carter, 1977, one of the most dramatic moments.
That was a great moment in the aftermath of Watergate and Vietnam, with so many people just frustrated with the presidency. He decided during the parade to just get out of the car with his wife and their daughter, Amy, and they just walked. And at the moment, that was a dramatic thing to do. People in the crowd couldn't believe that the president got out of the limo. And symbolically, it was really important. Carter was thinking of all the anger that existed in this country, and he wanted to show it would be a different kind of presidency, less pomp and more about the people. And that became a great event.
Yeah. Well, his Secret Service agents were pretty shocked, too, when he said, stop the limousine. You know, we always had to worry about security, but that was, you know, quite a moment. And you, Julian Zelizer, are saying, you know, why not think of what the new moments could be as we go ahead? Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. A resilient city and region relies on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve Greater Boston's most serious problems, from the hardships of COVID to the fight for racial equity and other important issues that affect the lives of everyone in our community. Learn how you can help build a Greater Boston that works for everyone by partnering with the Boston Foundation at tbf.org/partner.
Republicans have added hundreds of conservative judges to the bench during the Trump administration, and now a group of progressive activists is calling on the next president to turn the tables and start nominating a slate of liberal judges right away. The groups have already provided Joe Biden's transition team with more than 100 names of candidates who they say can help rebalance the federal bench. Christopher Kang is with Demand Justice, one of the groups that's been pushing this idea. Chris, welcome, and tell us how exactly you'd like to see Biden rebalance the courts.
Sure. Well, you know, there are a lot of different ways to look at how President Trump has shifted the courts. Judges are more conservative than they've ever been before. They are younger. They're also less diverse than we've seen in a generation. And so there's a lot that President Biden could do to help repair the balance and help restore the legitimacy of the courts.
And so groups like yours have put together a list for the president-elect. What kind of judges are on that list? Who do you want to see appointed?
Yeah, so there are a lot of organizations who are working hard to make sure that President-elect Biden has names of possible lawyers who could serve on the bench. And one of the things that we're looking at is professional diversity in particular. We know that judges throughout history, even appointed by Democratic presidents, have been overwhelmingly prosecutors or corporate lawyers. And there have not been enough lawyers representing individual people, not enough public defenders or plaintiffs' lawyers or labor lawyers or civil rights lawyers. And those are the kinds of people who are really going to be necessary to restore balance also to the kinds of lawyers who are represented on our judiciary.
Well, the Trump administration has made appointing conservative judges a cornerstone of its effort to cement its legacy. But in a way, it was able to do this because there were hundreds of court vacancies that they could fill. Trump has now filled many of them. So at this point, is Biden's opportunity even as close to the same?
Well, it won't be out of the gate. President Trump had well over 100 vacancies to start, and President-elect Biden will have somewhere in the 50 to 60 range. But over the next 4 years, a number of judges will likely retire, judges in particular who may have been appointed by President Clinton or even appointed by a Republican president, but didn't want to give President Trump an opportunity to nominate their replacement because they saw just how extreme his judges were. And so I think over time, there will be an opportunity for President-elect Biden to appoint a lot of judges and start to repair the balance in the judiciary.
Biden is a moderate politician. That's how and why he was elected. He's a Senate traditionalist. Do you think that he would be open to making the appointment of liberal judges a priority? I mean, is that something that you think will even be up front on his agenda?
I do. I really do. Because in part, I think that you have to look currently at his current cabinet. Again, it is very diverse, and there's some real progressive champions. There are champions on his economic team. His appointment of Representative Deb Haaland is the first Native American secretary anywhere, leading the Interior Department, sort of the way he's taking on climate change. He's starting to show that he understands that these big problems require big solutions. And you remember, one of Joe Biden's first jobs as a lawyer was as a public defender. He talks a lot about how he left the law firm to become a public defender. So I think he understands the importance of the courts. He was chairman of the judiciary when he was serving as a senator. And I think that with progressives really understanding and mobilizing around it in a way that we never have before, there's going to be a lot of pressure to make sure that President-elect Biden and the Democratic Senate have all the support they need to put these important nominees through.
Look, I mean, liberals were horrified at what President Trump did with his judicial appointments. You've laid that out. Progressives hated it. But would it really be different if progressives turned around and did the same thing? I mean, isn't this rush to appoint judges just kind of further politicizing the judicial system?
Well, I think that it depends on how you're looking at it. I think, first of all, Republicans have so politicized the judicial system that I think Democrats have to think about not allowing Republicans to play by one set of rules and Democrats be held by another. But also, it depends. Like, do I think that Democrats are going to do everything that Republicans have done? No. I don't think that Democrats are going to pick a lawyer who's been 8 years out of law school and has never tried a case and put them in as a trial court judge. I think there's sort of bare standards that Democrats will adhere to that will really make sure that the courts aren't too politicized. But I do think that they absolutely need to be putting more of a priority on judges. And that includes not just moving them more quickly, but again, thinking about how these judges can be reflective of the entire legal profession. So a different kind of judge, and really making sure that these vacancies are prioritized in a way that they weren't before.
How much of your plan hinges on the results of the Senate runoffs in Georgia? Because if Democrats don't get control of the Senate, it's going to be pretty hard to confirm the judges you want to see Biden nominate.
Well, obviously, a lot will depend on the outcome in Georgia. But I think our position is that regardless of the outcome, you know, President-elect Biden has to nominate the kinds of lawyers that he wants to see on the bench. He has to make very clear what a Biden judge looks like. And then it's going to be up to us in Demand Justice to sort of help, and other organizations to help corral the progressive energy that's moving around the courts and make sure that there's a lot of support to call out the hypocrisy of possibly not moving nominees and to really build a movement in order to get these nominees confirmed.
Christopher Kang, co-founder and chief counsel of Demand Justice, thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
If you're a parent, you might relate to this next story. It has been a struggle to keep schools open this year. The surge in COVID-19 cases and teacher quarantines have triggered dizzying switches from in-person to remote classes and then back again. And that is excruciating for many working parents with younger children. Amy Fireisel of North Country Public Radio has the story of two families who are trying to make things work.
This spring was a whirlwind for the Dusso family. They live in the northeastern corner of New York State, and like so many other families, they scrambled when schools went remote in March.
We borrowed a laptop from my mother-in-law. You know, we had to set up workstations in the kids' bedrooms. It was a daunting task, to say the least.
That's Steve Dusso, father to three elementary school-aged kids. Dusso and his wife both work full-time. So pre-COVID-19, school was childcare. This spring, they leaned heavily on Steve's mother-in-law.
She was driving 45 minutes to an hour south to try and teach kids Common Core math, which, I mean, thank God my kids are smart.
This summer, Dusso did a lot of shift trading at work. He's a corrections officer, to get on night shifts. He was staying awake for 36-hour stretches to fill in their childcare gaps. He and his wife were really looking forward to the kids being back in school. Then there was a big coronavirus outbreak in a nearby nursing home, and their school district went remote for the first 5 weeks of classes. Dusso kept working nights.
I would get home in the morning and stay up to try and get them started until my mother-in-law got there. I would go to sleep, and then, you know, the kids, they're kids, seeing their friends on a video chat, I kind of just swallowed the pill of, this is what parenting is now, and, you know, it was a toll.
Dusso says they have a cobbled-together plan in case there are more closures, and that they're really grateful for the family support that they have. Without grandparents or other family members nearby, things get a lot harder. That's where Sierra Wade Ganack is. She's a single mother of an 11-year-old boy and a 9-year-old girl in the Adirondack Mountains of New York. She says she's been racked with anxiety since the spring, and she had to take a lot of time off work, trying to balance that and her kids.
I was so incredibly anxious the whole time because I felt so guilty that I was choosing work over being a mother, which is, for anybody that's a parent, knows how horrible of a feeling that is.
Wade Ganack provides direct home care, so she can't work remotely. There are no childcare centers in Tupper Lake, where she lives, and her support system is almost non-existent.
I don't have any family. I don't have anybody that I would, you know, it's more than just watching my kids. It's also helping and being responsible for their schoolwork throughout the day.
Her kids spent the summer with their dad, so Wade Ganack could keep working. When school opened in the fall, she found a tenuous balance. A friend got the kids on the bus in the morning, and Wade Ganack left work early each day to meet them at 2:30. But that all came crashing down in mid-November. Due to rapidly rising COVID-19 cases, all the schools in their county went remote, planning to stay that way until early January. While the kids were devastated,
they were so disappointed and they were so sad.
Wade Ganack was frantic. She had very little paid time off left. As it disappeared, she saw no option other than taking an unpaid leave of absence. She had no idea what she'd do about money.
When that time comes, I'm going to have to figure something else out.
In early December, in the nick of time, a new program opened in the next town over. It supervises kids in person while they do remote schoolwork. Wade Ganack got her kids in the program and breathed a sigh of relief. Just a few days later, the county also reversed its decision and went back to in-person learning. So for now, Wade Ganack has it worked out. But she wishes there was more support for people who are finding themselves in her position because of the pandemic. She says her workplace has made it clear that her kids are her problem.
When I ask for work, for help, you know, their thing is always, there isn't anybody that you can send your kids to, like, as if they're, you know, not even real people. I'm sorry. It's just, it puts you in a horrible position.
She's hoping for the best, but worries that rising cases regionally and nationwide will put her right back between a rock and a hard place. For Here and Now, I'm Amy Feiereisel.
Tucked away in the coronavirus relief bill, among the much-needed unemployment relief and the one-time $600 checks for Americans, is a new deduction for corporate meal expenses. Now, there's a 1950s Mad Men cocktail culture term for these business meals. It's the three-martini lunch. And they were 50% deductible. Now it's 100%, a tax break championed by President Trump as a way to help restaurants in the pandemic. And just one of dozens of tax breaks sprinkled through the more than 5,000 pages of this bill. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, has read them all. Well, maybe most. And Robin, start with this tax break for the three martini lunch. 100% deductible. Why?
That sweetens the pot. I mean, corporations are now able to look at this. It hasn't been 100% deductible since, I believe, the 1980s. I mean, Gordon Gekko was doing it. President Trump came out for it in the spring. He remarked, they'll send their executives, they'll send people there, and they get a deduction. That is something that will really bring life back to the restaurants. I think make them hotter than before.
Well, and Democrats did not want this, but they gave it up for something else, or they took it for something else. What did they get?
Well, Democrats traded it for relief on the earned income tax credit, an additional child tax credit. So that'll prevent the tax code from punishing people who weren't able to hit a certain threshold of income this year. So both credits are kind of a backdoor way of getting extra cash when you could only kind of negotiate for a $600 or $300 payout otherwise.
Right. And what are restaurants saying in response to this idea that, you know, everybody arguing that it's good for the economy? What do restaurants say and what do economists say?
Look, tax considerations are not the first thing that come to mind when you're dining out. Clearly, COVID is the biggest damper on, you know, the full ticketed sit down restaurant experience right now. And if that's what you are chiefly worried about, then there are far more direct ways to rescue and backstop restaurants, which we know they're in a depression. So there is some gratitude, no doubt. And the National Restaurant Association, it said that fresh small business funding in the Paycheck Protection Program is going to help their members. But you're also seeing pleas for more direct relief. So many of these restaurants are not going to be able to survive the winter and hang on just long enough for a full-fledged post-vaccine return to kind of dining out with desserts and wines and tips and fully staffed restaurants.
Right. Well, the bill also included other tax benefits that will stay in place after the pandemic is over. Can you just give us the laundry list in the minute we have?
Yeah, I mean, it's a priority for each party. There are legal protections for businesses operating during the pandemic. Republicans really had sought that. There's direct aid for state and local governments that Democrats and some GOP lawmakers had pressed to include. There's kind of some last second pork barreling. There are provisions for flood control in the Army Corps, for Amtrak, for mass transit, bailouts for mass transit operators that are deeply in the red. So a lot of this is being looked at as a stopgap for President elect Biden and whatever he can negotiate with the Senate that is or isn't of the other parties.
And by the way, is that three martini lunch deduction shooting up to 100%? Is that a permanent tax credit?
Remains to be seen if that can be clawed back. I think it is going to remain controversial. It is being looked at face value as something that helps the restaurant industry. But the 50% thing lasted for several decades. So let's see how long this one lasts.
Right. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thanks as always.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Christmas is always a little melancholy for me. Both parents died on Christmas. Yes, it was decades ago. Sometimes people ask, oh, well, you're over it, right? You do the stages thing? Well, it turns out that stages of grief thing was not true. It was misappropriated. We'll get to that. And what about the millions of Americans who are grieving the nearly 320,000 who've died of COVID-19 and the thousands more who died of other illnesses in hospitals, all cut off from loved ones, in this, the deadliest year in America? Hope Edelman is author of the 1994 bestseller Motherless Daughters and now The After Grief. It offers a new way of looking at grief, not as a period on a sentence, but a process that shapeshifts and lasts a lifetime and can enrich us. Hope, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And as we mentioned this to colleagues, you know, several people said, how do we get here? How do we get to this notion that grief ends? And you lay out a fascinating history of grieving. We used to have customs. We put wreaths on doors or spent months in black. Enter Freud, who gets blamed for everything nowadays. But in 1917, he wrote a paper, and this is in the middle of World War I and the flu pandemic. And he said in this paper, in essence, that grief comes to a successful completion. You have to detach from the thing you lost.
You're absolutely right. In 1917, Sigmund Freud published a paper called Mourning and Melancholia. And that paper presented mourning as a very individual interior process. Prior to that, mourning had been a collective endeavor. When we think of Victorian mourning rituals, they were very elaborate. But Freud's paper came in the middle of a 1-2-3-4 punch in Western society, which began with World War I and then the Spanish flu pandemic, and also the women's suffrage movement, where women were gaining more independence because middle-class women were the ones who were predominantly responsible for all of the Victorian mourning codes. And so there was this tsunami of grief. Too many people were dying too close together for the Victorian mourning rituals to still be practical. Also during the flu pandemic, like now, people were afraid to gather. And the society began to think of mourning as an individual process rather than one that was shared with other mourners.
Well, and as you write, Freud had his own epiphany about this when his daughter died at 36. And then a few years later, her young son died, his beloved grandson. And he wrote to a friend and he said, you know what? In essence, I'm wrong. Your acute state of mourning will subside, but you're never going to get over this because why would you want to? It's the only way of perpetuating that love which we do not want to relinquish. That didn't get out, though, as much as his paper did, so we're left with people being called unhealthy or abnormal if they continue to mourn. And then, fast forward several decades, you have Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She came up with the five stages of dying: anger, denial, moving through to acceptance. Somehow that got turned into five stages of grieving, which is different.
That's correct. In both of these instances, their ideas took on a life of their own. And Kubler-Ross is on the record many times saying, I never intended for grief to be interpreted as a series of siloed emotions. But that idea, just like Freud's, took on a life of its own. It was very seductive in the culture to think this pain has an end point and there's a pathway to getting there. And I thought the same thing. I was 17 when my mother died. I remember looking at the pamphlet of the five stages of grief and thinking, check, 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 check. Here I am at acceptance. And this was the day of her funeral.
And it took you decades to have that old grief come back like a boomerang at you, which is what happens. And by the way, I'm so sorry about the loss of your mom at 17. But you say just two stages of grief. What are they?
Well, what I've found, it's the one where you feel really bad and the one where you start feeling better. And that one where you start feeling better, which then extends for the rest of your life, hasn't had a name. So we haven't had a vocabulary really to talk about it and acknowledge, yeah, this isn't something that we get over. We find new and different ways to carry our loved ones forward with us. And that's what I'm calling the after grief.
Now, many people who've lost someone think about them every single day. Talk about some of the names that you've assigned to some of these things. I mentioned a grief spike. What are some of the things that should be expected?
When I looked at the different types of grief that I was feeling over this long arc, occasionally I have what is known as a grief spike. Rebecca Sofer of Modern Loss calls them sneak attacks. I think that's a good word too. Those are those moments when you might just be driving in the car and a song comes on the radio that reminds you of your loved one. It's like that gut punch, you know, where you feel, oh gosh, I miss that person so much. It feels like losing them all over again, but it really doesn't. It feels like something else because those feelings move through us. It may be minutes, hours. That's what I call old grief. It is a response in the present to a loss in the past. But there's another category that I call new old grief, which is when we experience an old loss in a new way. And that's typically a one-time event, a graduation, a wedding, becoming a parent. When we long for that person who's not with us, when we long for their advice, we long for their comfort, a big one is reaching and passing your parents' age at time of death. Because you are looking back at the same set of facts and you're gaining a different insight from them. My mother will always have died of breast cancer in 1981 when I was 17 and she was only 42 years old. That looked a certain way to me at 17. But I looked at those set of facts very differently when I approached and turned 42. And again, when I passed it, because I realized how very young my mother was and how much she had missed out on. And that's an example of what I call new old grief.
Yeah. You know, all your work is about validating that grief doesn't stop. But you say that not letting yourself experience it, you say this is one of the most undiagnosed public health issues of our time.
I think so.
Why?
We know that grief that goes unexpressed can show up later in life as specific physical and mental ailments like depression, unrestrained anger, hypertension. But sometimes among adults, we cannot attend to our own grief. I believe this is what we are seeing now during the COVID era. I'm deeply concerned about the one-year anniversaries coming up in the spring of the first known deaths to COVID because so many of us were on survival mode. that we could not attend to our own grief. We also couldn't engage in the familiar and comforting rituals that we were used to. So when we go on survival mode, we have to postpone our grief. That 1 year point is naturally when people feel a dip anyway, because they realize I made it through that first year. I've steeled myself against the first year. And now my reward is that I get to do it again and again and again.
Well, so what do people do? We're approaching Christmas without family. I mean, even people who haven't lost loved ones have lost touch with them. So there's some mourning there. But then, of course, the people who have lost loved ones, this is a potentially a profound day for some, or the sense of holiday, and you're not with loved ones. You know, you do something with women who travel miles to be there when there's going to be a triggering day coming up for them. And part of it sounds like a 12-step meeting where they go around and for 5 minutes, people can just pour out anything they want to pour out. How do you do that if you're not with a trained facilitator?
Writing it down is the best way to do it. Just free writing. Give yourself 5 minutes, set a timer, write for 5 minutes about something that you've been holding in, something you'd like to let out. Share it with a compassionate other. Just one person can do that for you. It can be a close friend. It can be a family member. Someone who won't ask you, aren't you over it yet?
You talk about talking. If, you know, that person is going to be showing up in your life anyway, you're not crazy if you interact with that, whatever that is, the memory.
No. I mean, the next wave of grief theory that came after stage theory is what's known as the relational theory of grief. The idea that trying to let go of our attachment to loved ones who died was causing more pain than comfort. That in fact, what we naturally yearn to do is find new ways to stay connected to these loved ones as we move forward without them in the physical world. Around the holidays, it can be as simple as telling stories about them or continuing a tradition, even in an abbreviated form, is very important this year, because one of the things that COVID has disrupted is everyone's relationship or form of relationship between the past, the present, and the future. We're kind of in a suspended present tense right now, adjusting to big changes in real time. But traditions and rituals are elements from the past that we can engage in the present with a hope that we will be able to continue them in the future.
Well, there's so much more from Hope Edelman in her new book, The After Grief. Thank you so much for speaking with us about, you know, how to get through it. That's not even right, because that implies an ending too, doesn't it?
Right. It's about how to move forward with it.
Hope, thank you.
Thank you so much, Robin.
If 2020 wasn't difficult enough, the International Union for Conservation of Nature has updated its list of threatened species, and the headline is not good. 31 plant and animal species have just been downgraded on the so-called red list. They are now extinct. John Paul Rodriguez is the chair of the IUCN's Species Survival Commission, and he joins us now from Caracas, Venezuela. John, not all the species on this list are recently extinct, including a shark that hasn't been seen since 1934. Why did it take so long to say the lost shark was extinct?
So if you look at the instructions, our book, per instruction book, it says you have to look for the species everywhere, in any season, any time of day. We're using all the possible methods to measure the presence. So it's a really strict set of conditions that we have to meet. So we only declare them when we're fairly sure, and that sometimes can take a few decades to confirm that. But, you know, if we say it's extinct, it's really unlikely they'll be found again.
Well, unfortunately, 15 freshwater fish species in the Philippines are now extinct, according to your calculation. What's behind their disappearance?
You know, freshwater systems in general are amongst the most threatened of all ecosystems. Those are the ones that we interact with most. So there are lots of causes, but the main causes in this case is introduced species. You know, we put in species from other parts of the world, we introduce them into our river systems, and they eat up the native species. So that, combined with over-harvesting, you know, just fishing them too much and consuming them. But exotic species are a major threat to freshwater systems, and these freshwater fish are victims of that.
Well, I'm looking at your corner of the world in South America. A freshwater dolphin found in the Amazon River system was added to your endangered list. Thankfully, there's still a chance to keep that animal on the planet. But it also means that all species of freshwater dolphins are on the brink of extinction. So what's the significance of that dire news?
One of the main reasons that they are is because they get trapped in fishing nets. So some of the fishing is not for the dolphins, it's for fishes. And this is the case for most freshwater dolphins all over the world. Also dam building, you know, we are determined to produce electricity and save water. I mean, things that are important to humans naturally, and they have big impact over freshwater dolphins. And developing new fishing techniques, restricting some of the most destructive ones, unifying governments and their policies are all things that are within our reach, things that we can do. So we can certainly prevent this.
And it's not just the animals. The Red List says a third of the world's population of oak trees are now in danger.
Yeah, no, that's interesting because sometimes you think, you know, if you live in North America and the U.S., you think of oak trees as these trees that are lining the streets and they're beautiful. But my favorite by far is an oak. But some of these oak trees that live in mountains and cloud forests in high places, and they're subject to logging and other activities. And the way that we do things in the Red List is that we take an entire group of species, like the oaks or the proteas, which is the other species group of plants that you'll find in this last release, and then we assess all of them so that we get an idea of the group threat.
I see. Well, I do want to highlight what can happen when things go right. The population of European bison, which you had upgraded from vulnerable to near threatened, there were reportedly only 1,800 of these animals back in 2003, but last year the numbers rose to more than 6,000. What happened with the European bison that was such a success that maybe could be replicated elsewhere?
Yes, well, in fact, it has been replicated already. The American bison went through a similar story of being extinct in the wild and now being a species that is near threatened. And I think the key message for me of these two stories is that conservation works. And the problem is that we don't do enough of it. And, you know, much more is invested in destroying nature than in saving it. So if we did a bit more of it, we could recover many of these species. Nature really bounces back if we give her a chance. And this case of the European bison, which you can imagine is some of the most populated places in the world, but they have found a way to coexist with bisons. And I am sure that we can find a way to do this with many species everywhere else.
I know you've been working on these red lists for many years. I wonder how this year compares to past and how the losses that we're seeing now, you know, might be exacerbated in a way they weren't a decade ago or two decades ago because climate change is getting so much worse, and the threat appears to be much more imminent around the world.
Yeah, no, climate change operates at a scale that is a bit slower than some of these other threats, like overexploitation or habitat destruction. So it takes a bit longer to be captured by the global red list. So there are very few species in the world that you can declare their state due to climate change. But it's difficult to say whether this year is worse than other years. But if you look at the aggregate change over time, it is clear that the status of species is declining everywhere. So what we're hoping to do with the Red List is not just highlight that species are declining, but also use that as an incentive for action. And we hope to get countries around the world to help us do that by implementing conservation action in their countries at the local level.
John Paul Rodriguez is the chair of IUCN's Species Survival Commission, which has declared another 31 plant and animal species around the world extinct. John, thank you.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.
With a COVID-19 vaccine going into arms around the world, you may be dreaming of a post-pandemic return to normalcy. One doctor says you may have to wait 2 years or more. That's next time on Here and Now.